If you're struggling in your marriage, there's a lot of advice someone can give you. There's a lot of counsel someone can argue for you or put in front of you to help you. Good things that need to be discussed, that should be discussed, but fundamentally what will help you the most, what's most practical, is just good, sound theology. To look at these passages, to understand this is who God is, this is who Christ is, and it impacts our understanding of these things.
So here's a question as we begin our time together today on Growing in Grace with Pastor Steve Ballantyne from San Gabriel Community Church. How is your compartmentalized life? Do you have yourself cut up? Well, this part is for the church, this part is for business, this part is for family. You know, when it comes to the supremacy of Christ, He is supreme over all of your life, not just simple compartments that you've assigned to Him. And that is what we'll find out today as we continue our journey through the book of Colossians. We're in chapter 1, looking at verses 15 through 23. Join us there, won't you, for today's Growing in Grace. Here's Pastor Steve Ballantyne.
Chapter 1, follow along with me, would you, as we read this section. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. And you, who once were alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death in order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before him, if indeed you continue in the faith, stable and steadfast, not shifting from the hope of the gospel that you heard, which has been proclaimed in all creation under heaven, and of which I, Paul, became a minister. This is about the supremacy of Christ, the sufficiency of Christ. It answers the question for us, who is Christ? We see this question come up time and again in the Gospels. And I challenged you last week, you read through the Gospels and what you see in Colossians 1 is it's almost like a cliff note of all of Christ's gospel ministry. I was reading in Mark this week, and where he calms the storms. Remember, he tells his disciples after a long day of ministry, they're all exhausted, and he says, okay, let's go to the other side of the sea. And so they get in the boat, and Christ goes down underneath to sleep. In the midst of this sleep, a storm comes up. And his disciples are trying to do everything they can to save the boat, and they realize we're going to die. So they go down, and they get Jesus, and they say, what, do you want us to die? Do you want us to perish? And Christ gets up, walks out, looks at the storm, looks at the sea, and says, okay, stop. And it stops. Can you imagine that scene? It just stops. And I really don't think there was a winding down. I'm reading between the lines here. But I think there was tumult. There was waves crashing the boat. Jesus says, stop. And I think it was just glass. Do you remember what the disciples, they looked at each other and said, who is this? Specifically, what manner of man is this that can command creation, that can command the sea and the storm? What kind of man is on our boat? If Paul were on the boat and it were some 30 years later, he would have said this to his disciples. He would have said to the disciples, he is the image of the invisible God. He is the firstborn of all creation. All of this that he just commanded, it is from him. It emanated from him. He spoke it into existence. And it is by him that it's sustained. And it is for him that it exists. He is supreme in all of creation. For he is the creator. He is the Christ. And that's what we looked at last week. That Christ is God. He is preeminent in all of creation. because he is the one that created it. He is the one that holds it together. Now, Paul moves in his thinking from who Christ is in creation to who Christ is in the church. And this is a crucial sequence for us to see, that he starts with Christ in creation. That's where he begins. He's creating a foundation for us to understand the issues in the church. See, he's dealing with issues in the church, but he doesn't start with who Christ is in relationship to the church. Why? Why start with the broader picture? And the answer is because the one who Christ is in all of creation serves as the foundation for who Christ is in the church. You cannot understand Christ's relationship to his church until you first understand Christ in relationship to the universe. We'll be deficient in our understanding of the glory of God's and Christ's activity for us in redemption until we see the glory of Christ's activity in all of creation. So this foundation, in theology we call it Christology, this theology forms the foundation of the very practical matters of dealing with the church that Paul is going to go after. And we've said this time and again, that theology is practical. Paul's not just throwing out, here's some truths about Christ, you know, file them away, they're good to know. He's saying, no, you must have this foundation of who Christ is to understand who he is in relationship to the church. Theology is practical for all of lives. Who Christ is practical for us to understand relationships. And this is a hobby horse I know I get on often, but it's so crucial for us to understand that the things of God, knowing Christ, are not just abstract thoughts that we hold so that we can pass some theology exam or so we can look knowledgeable in discussions, but theology is crucial to life. Recently was doing premarital counseling, and we had just a few sessions to meet together. And there are great books on marriage that we could have studied and are worth reading. There is a list of things that you can talk about in regard to marriage that will serve a young couple. But if you have limited time, you know what you talk about? You talk about theology. You go to Ephesians 5. If you have one session, one foundation to talk about marriage, let's talk about the theology of marriage. Husbands, love your wife the way Christ loves the church. Wives, submit to your husbands the way the church is subject to Christ. That's where you start. If you're struggling in your marriage, there's a lot of advice someone can give you. There's a lot of counsel someone can argue for you or put in front of you to help you. Good things that need to be discussed, that should be discussed, but fundamentally what will help you the most, what's most practical, is just good, sound theology. To look at these passages, to understand this is who God is, this is who Christ is, and it impacts our understanding of these things. So he says, you will not submit to the supremacy of Christ in the church, that's what's at stake, unless you've submitted to his supremacy in all of creation. And so that's where he begins. But then in verse 18, he moves from the cosmic picture of Christ in creation to the temporal, to his relationship to this group of believers called the church. We're reminded, though oftentimes it can be quite discouraging when you look at what is happening in the church, that the gates of hell will not prevail against Christ building his church. That no matter what gimmick comes along, no matter what deficiencies there are in the visible church that's in front of us, Christ is building his church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. That he will be successful in the building of his church, but he is central to it, and he must be the foundation of it. To help guide our thoughts in these verses, we'll put it in the form of five truths. Five truths about Christ, about his nature, about his activity, that show us why he is the Lord over the church. Christ must be the Lord over the church, not just of creation, but of the church. The church globally, and he must be the Lord over our church locally. He must reign supreme. Here's the first truth. Christ is the head. Christ is the head. This is what Paul says in verse 18. He is the head of the body, the church. The body is the church, and Christ is the head. This is a metaphor that Paul is fond of using. You see it in 1 Corinthians 12. You see it in Romans 12. The connection between the idea that we're a body and that we're working together and that we're functioning together. In that function, in that body, Christ is the head. Now, this metaphor is intended to teach us something. It was intended to convey something to them, to be instructive about the relationship between Christ and the church. So let's just think through this together a little bit. I'll think out loud. You just think to yourselves. Otherwise, it'd just be confusing. But what are the implications of the statement that Christ is the head of the church? Okay? Let me give you a number of them. First, if Christ is the head of the church, and as we saw last week, Christ is the preeminent one in all of creation, he's the head of creation, that tells us that the purpose of creation and the purpose of the church are bound together. Christ is the head of all creation. Christ is the head of the church. Is Christ going to be contra his own purpose? So we're just reminded, just implicitly looking at the context where he establishes Christ's supremacy in creation, and then since Christ is supreme in the church, he's the head of the church. We say, wait a second. Then probably what he's doing in all of creation is what he's doing in the church. That the church doesn't stand contra the purposes of Christ in all of creation. The great implications of this, that the purpose of the churches are far beyond the ministry of a building with four walls. That the purpose of the church is far beyond a small group of people that meets together on a Sunday morning. That the purposes of the church are much more cosmic than we often think when we think of the church. The church is not simply about what God is doing in one small room on a Sunday morning. God is doing something cosmic. God is doing something grand in all of creation. God is reconciling all of creation to himself. God is bringing glory to himself in all of history, coming to this end where God is glorified, God is magnified, Christ is exalted. And he says, church, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to invite you to be part of it. You're part of this. You're a piece of this as the church to move along with God in this purpose. Well, we're reminded in this, the church is not about us, right? It's about God. It's about Christ. It's about his purposes. The church doesn't exist for us. I can't tell you how often when people talk about church, they talk about church in a way that sounds like the church exists for them. Why isn't the church meeting this need in me? Why isn't the church doing this for me? Now, there are needs to be met in the church, and we're called biblically to meet them. But fundamentally, I'm going to rock your world this morning. The church is not about you. The church is not about me. The church is not about just looking at you and saying, okay, how can we make sure that so-and-so's happy? How can we make sure that all of their needs are met? And then the next person comes along and they complain and say, okay, now we got to make sure all their needs are met. No, the church is about all of us recognizing it's not about us, it's about Christ. And it's about his purposes and his desires for us. And the church does not simply exist to maintain its existence. It does not exist just for the sake of existing. It's fascinating. You look at church history. You want to recognize God's hand on the church. Just look at church history. God sustaining the church. And when the church begins to go astray in huge ways, God says, all right, time to bring reformation. And he raises up people to reform the church. And the church again starts to move away. And God says, okay, we need revival. And he brings revival. And the church goes away again. He says, we need another revival. God is sustaining his church. There's no other explanation. There's no human explanation for us to still be sitting here this morning, 2,000 years after the cross, save that God is at work in his church. And so we exist for the same purpose of creation. We exist for the glory of the one who is most glorious. We exist for the glory of the one who is our head. We exist to fulfill his purposes. We exist to be part of fulfilling the redemptive purpose of Christ as he moves and he works and he acts to redeem a people for himself. He says, church, you get to be part of this. What a great privilege to stand with him in this work. Well, that's subpoint one, so I should probably keep moving. Okay, subpoint two. Implications of the church, of the reality that Christ is the head. It means that the church is inseparable from Christ. Isn't that a logical implication? If Christ is the head and we are the body, guess what? Remove the head and what do you have? You have death. We cease to exist. Though it seems people try, right? You cannot function without your head. It's a requirement to be living. I have a conversation this week about two different conversations with people about things that doctors are talking about removing from their bodies. It's amazing to me. Like, hey, we can take that out. I'm like, well, don't I need it? Like, yeah, well, we got other things, right? It's amazing, those conversations. You can't take off the head. If there is no head, there is no life. Do you think it's an accident? Do you think it's an accident that the church's influence on the world around us and the culture that we find ourselves in that has grown increasingly less? At the same time, the church has become put less and less emphasis on the person and the nature of Christ. That our influence in culture has diminished, while at the same time we've stopped emphasizing in the churches the gospel and the person and nature of Christ. There's a connection between those things. Another implication, there's an analogy with the body that points to unity and diversity. This is Paul's point in 1 Corinthians 12 and Romans 12, that we're all different, that God's body is diverse and yet unified for this one purpose, to function under the head. It implies, does it not, if Christ is the head, that Christ is sovereign and that he's ruling, that he is the one who is in authority? That's what it means. The head is the one that tells everything else what to do. The head is the one that sustains life. The head is the one that instructs. The head is the one that gives direction. Christ is the head. I don't want to offend, if anybody's British this morning, I suppose I might offend them with this, but the church is not a constitutional monarchy. And yet, sometimes I think we treat Christ that way. That He's the king in the sense that the queen is still the queen of Great Britain. We pay honor to him and we sing about him and we write about him in all of our documents and we speak to the influence that he has. But when push comes to shove, in the day-to-day realities of our existence, we resist his direction. We rely on our own wisdom. We rely on our own methods. We rely on our own means. And he becomes just a figurehead with no real authority. If he's the head, he is the ruler. If he's the head, then he is the source from which we derive all of our life and all of our strength. If he's the head, it offers us encouragement that whatever harebrained idea, and there are a lot of them out there, whatever idea some man comes up with, Christ will not let the body die. When we forsake his word, Christ will bring reform to his church. He will not let his church die. He will build his church. He will sustain its life. To say that Christ is ahead pictures a relationship that is living and organic and vital. To say that Christ is the head is to say that all authority within the institutions that God has established is derived authority. Just how in the marriage relationship in Ephesians 5, that ultimately the submission is to Christ. And that manifests itself in daily relationship, in the relationship of marriage. So it is in the church. All authority in the church that God establishes, the authority of the elders, is not because of who they are. It is a derived authority. They are under shepherds, right? We who serve the great shepherd. This is his church, and all authority as elders is simply a derived authority. Christ is the ultimate authority. If Christ is the head of the church, it pictures dependence, his influence, and his presence. One commentator, J.B. Lightfoot, he said this. He said, Jesus is the inspiring, ruling, guiding, combining, sustaining power of the church, the mainspring of its activity, the center of its unity, and the seat of its life. Christ is the head. As Paul moves forward from this declaration in verse 18, he begins to speak of what qualifies him, in essence, to be the head. What makes him the head of the church? And so he moves away from that statement at the end of 17 that he sustains all things. He's the image of the invisible God, and it moves towards the statement that he sustains all things. And then he moves out from that statement and begins to speak of his relationship to the church. First, he is the head. What qualifies him to be the head of the church? He is the beginning. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead. Verse 18 again, He is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead. No one else can make this claim. There is no other head. There's no other one that can claim to be the beginning. That doesn't probably have the same shock value it would have to this first century church. To a Jewish mind, for someone to say, I am the beginning, would have been absolute heresy. We see that in Christ's interaction with the disciples. It's recorded for us in John chapter 8. Right, the Pharisees come to him and they're making accusations against him. And at some point in the debate, they ask him, are you greater than our father Abraham? Right, because no one's greater than Abraham. And he says, I tell you what, Abraham was excited to see me come. And then he says, before Abraham was, what? I am. This is what Paul's reiterating here. He is the beginning. He is preeminent. He is the firstborn from the dead. Now, just note back as a way of making a connection here. If you look back at verse 15, we touched on this last week. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. And just to help you in your evangelistic apologetic life, okay? And I've seen this happen time and time again. This is the favorite text, right up there with John 1, of the Jehovah's Witness when they come to your door and they're going to convince you that Christ is not God. They'll say, see, he's the firstborn from all creation. He's not God. He's the first created. And I made the point to you last week that firstborn there doesn't mean sequential, but supremacy, right? First in rank, first in order, first in importance. Now, you want to stump them because they don't know what to do with this. They believe, they don't deny that Lazarus, for example, was raised from the dead. There's no denial of that. So you ask him, can I ask you a question? You go to verse 18. You see, it says here that Christ is the firstborn from the dead. Is that to say that he was the first one raised from the dead? They would say no. Well, then what does it mean? If it's not the first in sequence, what's the point Paul's making? The same point he makes in verse 15. It's a statement of supremacy, a statement of rank, a statement of order. And he uses the word here in the same way that he uses it in verse 15. Other people were raised from the dead before Christ, but Christ is the firstborn from the dead. His resurrection is distinct. It is amazing that Lazarus was raised from the dead. It's an amazing story of Christ's power over death. But guess what? Lazarus died again. Lazarus didn't have a resurrected body. And Lazarus' resurrection meant nothing for me. It doesn't bring me any hope save the way Christ was involved. But Christ's resurrection, his was the first fruits, Paul calls it in 1 Corinthians 15. Because when he was risen from the dead, death was conquered.
This is Growing in Grace. Pastor Steve Ballantyne, our teacher and pastor from San Gabriel Community Church. As we conclude our time together today, we would remind you that these broadcasts are available on this radio station because you partner with us financially and prayerfully. It means a great deal to us knowing that you are being encouraged by these programs on a regular basis. To that end, we'd love to hear from you. How does the broadcast encourage you in Christ? If you have questions about the program, about the ministry, who we are, what we believe, we would love to hear from you. A great place to start would be our website, sangabrielcommunity.org. That's sangabrielcommunity.org. You'll find archives of past sermons available to listen to. Again, information about us, who we are, what we believe, and why. We also are home to San Gabriel Christian School, and there'll be information there as well about the school. Again, sangabrielcommunity.org. If you would like to join us for worship, Sunday services are at 9 and 10:45 for Sunday school. Directions and, again, information can be found at sangabrielcommunity.org or by simply calling 626-656-1000. That's 626-656-1000. Thank you so much for joining us today. Until next time, may the Lord richly bless you. Growing in Grace is the ministry of San Gabriel Community Church.